Okay, well, thank you for that very generous and not misleading, but very generous introduction. I've deliberately not added any jokes in. I've deliberately decided to not be telling jokes or cracking jokes, but I can't promise, so I'll try not to. So I'm going to talk about the tantric symbolism of colour. I'm going to be trying to stick to the script. I don't want to ad lib because I don't trust myself when I just start talking randomly, you know. So I'm going to stick to the script, and as a consequence, I'm going to be staring at the screen as I talk to you. I will try and just make sure that people are still present. I won't be sort of making any bids on eBay or anything. You can trust me that it is just a talk in front of me. And the theme of the talk that I was given by Arijai is the tantric symbolism of colour. And in looking at the theme initially, it wasn't a topic I would myself have come to necessarily to have listened to. It's not, the tantric isn't something that is personally of interest to me. And I did wonder if I had any sort of particular connection that I might be able to speak from. I was very fortunate to work as an art teacher, to be able to always really teach stuff that I was personally enthusiastic about. And so I wondered about this topic. Was there anything I personally might have a connection with? And two things sprang to mind. So the first was a phrase that some people here will maybe be very familiar with, is the phrase, work is a tantric guru. And that's a phrase that would be familiar to maybe anyone who's been involved in the past with Wind Horse Evolution, the Buddhist Right Livelihoods that sadly closed a few years ago. And for me, that phrase meant, and I imagine for others as well, is that you could use your work. Just open something. You could use your work as a vehicle for developing yourself spiritually. You could use, in fact, anything that you were doing. Dealing with internet problems, computer problems. Oh, there we go, good. So whatever you happen to be doing could be present you with opportunities to learn about yourself and present you with teachings. And that's something I very much experienced at Wind Horse and have experienced since. I found the work I've done, I've tried to turn it into a practice. And that sort of approach to practice, I think, could be summarized as the tantra makes use of whatever is available. The second point of contact I felt I had with tantra is with sadhana practice. So this is a practice that order members do, where they develop a relationship with the qualities of the awakened mind, and they do that in a sort of imaginative, meditative manner. Bringing their attention to a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. I'm not going to talk about sadhana practice in this talk, but I'm going to talk about stuff sort of related to it. And this second area of contact could be summarized as tantra makes available what's of use. So it makes available what's of use. If something would be beneficial but isn't present, that we can bring it into being, and we can do that through using our imagination. And what could be more useful than having a enlightened, perfectly pure spiritual guide to have contact with? So in terms of the first point, what making use of what's available in our experience. So one thing that is available in our experience, in all our visual experience, is colour. And what I'd like to ask people to do now is just a brief little exercise. I'd like you to just glance around the room. You've got 12 seconds. Glance around the room. Yeah? Okay, and now what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to glance around the room and notice as many different things as you can see, which are red. So again, you've got like about 20 seconds or so to do this. Okay. And so what I'd like you to do now is close your eyes. So allow your eyes to close. And I'd like you to bring to mind, and you probably know what's coming, but yeah, I'd like you to bring to mind all the things in the room that you're aware of that are green. Keep your eyes closed. Yep, nobody's cheating. So allow yourself to bring to mind all those things. So you've had a look around the room. You've been in it for a while. And now you're recollecting clearly in your memory and in your imagination all those green things, I assume, yeah? Okay, so you can open your eyes now. And suddenly someone snuck in and introduced loads of green stuff, haven't they? Yeah. So I wonder what might be the point there might be different points that exercise might illustrate. You know, there might, if you were to reflect on it, you might be some points that might occur to you. So one of the points I want to draw out is that, which is relevant to the theme, is that our memory and our experience is conditioned by and limited by what we pay attention to through our senses. And prior to that, our attention is conditioned and influenced by the agendas, intentions, needs, desires, wishes, etc. That we have. And these will be a mix of conscious and unconscious, as well as helpful and unhelpful agendas. So in that exercise, I set the agenda and you kindly played along. But ordinarily we have our own aims and hopes and wishes in any experience. This dictates what we pay attention to. And, well, in addition to our own agendas, we exist within a society and a cultural environment which puts a lot of resources and energy into catching and directing our attention and nudging and pushing it to follow different agendas. Some of these we may be dimly aware of, and they may run completely counter to our own best wishes for ourselves and others, and they make use of our attention, which is a limited resource. So one of the biggest problems with spiritual practice is that regardless of how sort of noble and sincere our intentions and aims are, is that our attention, my attention, gets diverted and we can forget those aims and we can forget those aspirations. And we can forget them for brief periods of time or we can forget them for quite sort of extended periods, days, years, lifetimes. We can just simply forget. So without any great intention to stop doing something or to deliberately move away from something, we can just quite easily drift. And isn't it a great shame, if that happens, to realise that one has forgotten something that was deeply important? And isn't it possibly quite tragic to realise then we don't have enough time to do anything about it? So given this danger of getting distracted and forgetting, it seems important that once we've decided for ourselves what is most important to us, that we have effective ways of bearing that in mind rather than just leaving it to chance. Colour is everywhere. And for me it seems like, you know, what a shame it would be if we have this amazing resource to not tap into it and make use of it. Um, I think it can be just on the topic of getting distracted, forgetting. So it can be an interesting practice to reflect back at maybe at the end of a day or on particular experiences and recall what was it we were paying attention to and what that thing we were paying attention to says about what our needs and wishes are. And that's something we can sort of, in a way, it's a sort of key aspect of practice. Where is your mind, where is your attention going to, and why is that? And was there a point during the day where we could have really benefited from a reminder of what's most important to us, what our sort of key values are? So I'd like us to do another little exercise now. And I'm going to invite you to look at something which you should be, which sort of we're commonly led to believe we're very familiar with. I'd like you to have a look at the back of your hand. So you can choose which hand. And actually you can look at the front of it as well if you like. It's not really, so you're the palm of your hand. And allow yourself, as best as your eyesight allows, to bring your attention to the range of colours in there. The range of different shades, different colours. Which ones would you say are the most visually dominant? Which ones sort of grab your attention? Which ones are more subtle? And as you're looking at the colours, you can leave aside the lines and the marks and what have you, or hairs, jewellery, what have you. Just focusing on the colours. Now, what I'm wondering is if you were describing to someone else the colours that you can see, do you feel confident that you have an accurate vocabulary to pinpoint the particular shades and the particular colours that are present there? Would you have, you know, how confident would you be? Maybe have a sense of being 100% confident or less than that, that you'd be able to communicate to someone who hadn't seen your hands what the specific colours are that are there. Just for a moment now, what you can do is if you could just put your hand next to a neighbour's and just have a look at the difference between, if there is a difference, is there anything you notice about the colours in your hand and the colours in theirs? Okay. So that exercise is obviously a mindfulness exercise, just bringing your attention to your experience. And it's also sort of interesting to notice that sort of gap between your experience and the language that we use to describe our experience. One exercise I used to do with these students when they were sort of first came in, 11, was give them some paints and ask them to mix up as many different colours as they could. And there's obviously, you know, a limited number of colours they're working with, and there's different factors that sort of influence how many shades they can produce. So how much pigment they have in the brush in relation to how much water, and then so they can just with one colour they can get a lot of different shades, a lot of different range of different shades of one colour, and then the mixing of the colours, and again the ratio there. So they can produce quite a range of colours. And then I would ask them to name the colours. Because I, you know, sort of nasty like that, you know? And And they would struggle, and I would struggle as well, and I wouldn't be able to say what the name of the colours were, I just couldn't. And you can only use the same word to describe a range of different colours before it just becomes meaningless. So you can have people using the same words to describe what are very, very different experiences. So again, it's just an exercise that points to the limits of language. And I don't know if you've ever looked through a medical dictionary of illnesses or something, but where we start matching up the words to our own experience and come away with half a dozen deadly illnesses not before long, yeah? So the language has got this sort of, it's quite inadequate to the richness of our actual experience. Just to dwell on sort of art again. So one of the biggest barriers to drawing from observation, so that's a sort of key skill in sort of art and the sort of standard aspect of art education, is that we've got this very clear concepts about what things are meant to look like. We've got very clear ideas about what something should look like, what hand should look like, what a face should look like, a flower, whatever it is. And that interferes with people's drawing something, and they think, well, it can't possibly look like that. That doesn't look like a hand or a flower or a face. And that sort of conceptual knowledge interferes with and can hijack people's ability to accurately draw what they see. So one of the key skills of observational drawing, and which I think is like a form of mindfulness, is putting to one side one sort of ready-made knowledge of what things should look like and how they should be, and just trusting what you're actually seeing. Now, a benefit of doing art is that the image that you produce can act as a record of what you've been, the subjective process of you seeing things, which you can compare as you're doing it, as you're drawing your thing. You can make this comparison between the object you're drawing and your image of it, and you can see and you can make mistakes and correct them. So there's that process of that dialogue between what you're looking at and your perception of it. And you've got this record of it, so you can see the mistakes you've made, you can see where you've made the corrections. And it's not uncommon to feel that one's really got it. You've really captured that person's face. I've had this, makes me cringe, some of the portraits I've done, where I feel like I've really got them, you know, I've really captured the person. And you go away, and you come back sometime later, and then you can see the mistakes. There's something about the process of that dialogue between the object and your perception of it, where it can be very tricky to see it objectively. And it's so easy, the number of portraits I've done of people where you can tell who it is, but just their eyes are just sort of drifting around the face a bit, or their forehead's just that little bit too small, or they just sort of look a bit quirky. Only one person here, I have to apologise on that front. So, but those portraits are hidden away. So it's the point I'm making is so tricky to be able to objectively see. And yet, thankfully, there's a record which you can come back to later, and also other people can see. Other people can see, and they can give you, you know, suggestions and feedbacks. You know, is the ears really that big, or what have you? So. If you were to contrast that with, say, meditative experience, where we can sometimes have that same sense, be really, really convinced that we've got it, you know, we've captured whatever it is, totally convinced, and yet because there's no record, and because other people can't objectively see what we've convinced ourselves of, that it's tricky. It's a tricky area. And that's not to say that people, obviously, people do make progress and do really, really see things. but there's a lack of a sort of capacity to really objectively see what that experience was. And I've done this myself. Before I came along to the Dublin Meditation Centre, where Sangapala was painting the town red, sort of with the Dharma, and you know, it's an amazing place. It's like the Dharmic version of the French Resistance. You know, so very good. I was putting off going down there because I wanted to wait until I'd gained insight before going down to do the introduction to meditation. Sorry, which bit's funny? And the reason I was doing, why I had that sort of idea, was because I'd got into Zen Buddhism, which is very focused on, you know, big experiences, and I've been meditating out in the shed by myself, you know, 3 hours at a stretch, could barely walk afterwards, you know. Everyone was very suspicious about what I was doing in the shed. I was absolutely meditating. And so I was understanding what for me were very big experiences in the context of these Zen stories of people gaining enlightenment because someone smacks them about the ear, or, you know, they stub their toe. And, you know, so I felt I was, you know, a whisker away. And yes, went to the Dublin Meditation Centre and just gave everyone migraines, talking them into the wall about no mind and stuff and what have you, yeah. So I really, myself, have got, you know, first direct-hand experience of completely mistaking where I was at. Just to say that capturing colour in particular, just to bring it back to the theme, can be tricky, partly because of how we perceive things. So on a sort of sense-based level, how we perceive things can make it quite tricky. And we have in our language a sort of confidence in things we've seen. So we talk about, we use the phrase of seeing is believing, I believe it when I see it, I saw it with my own eyes. And we can act as if we see something, then that's it. It's unquestionable. It is true. And it's like, well, how can you argue with something you've actually seen yourself? What grounds have you got for arguing? So I want to explore that just briefly with a little image that I want to show you. And hopefully everyone can see the image. It's okay. Thank you. So can everyone see the image? Yeah? Yeah, everyone can see the image, okay. So I hope I'm right in saying that, put your hand up if you disagree, that you will perceive the two squares in the two little squares as being different colours, different shades. So put your hand up if you can see them as being other than different. Sorry, that's I'm confusing you with my gibberish. So they look different. I can't remember what I said now. Yeah, so everyone, you think?
Yeah, they look similar.
They do look similar. True.
The same colour.
And you can see them as, no, what I'm asking you, sorry, I'm getting a bit cranky teacher there. So you can see them as the same, or as similar in a different way.
Slightly different.
Sangapala can see them as the same. Good man, great stuff. Correct answer. And so what I want to do is, there's always one. So now someone's going to say they see them as different. Sangapala?
No,
they're fine. Yeah, okay, yeah. No specs for him. Okay, so they are, when you take away the surrounding colour context, you can see that it's actually an identical colour. But I would argue, I might be wrong, that your eye's brain thing doesn't allow you to see them as they are because of our perception of colour. Like a lot of other things, is conditioned by the context around it, yeah? So earlier on we had a room full of people, we would all have agreed with each other, we'd left it at that, that the colours were different, and then you see it there and they're the same and now they're different. So your perception of the colour arises in dependence upon, one of the factors is, the colours that are around it. And that's part of what the Impressionists were doing with the way they put dabs of colour. And they. So what is that significant? Is the fact that our perception of something that we cannot, in a sense, trust our eyes. This is just one example of a optical illusion, and there are gazillions of them. I used to have a book in my classroom, which was a big phone book full of optical illusions, and it would just, weird stuff would happen. You know, you'd look at images, and there would be all sorts of weird stuff happening, not just in relation to colour, but in relation to shapes and perspective and all sorts. And in a sense, these optical illusions, I would say, are benign. They're sort of helpful. If we didn't have them, we would sort of struggle. I've recently seen a video of a chap who apparently was seeing colour for the first time. He put on some specs and he was just like, oh, you know, he was like gobsmacked staring at stuff and he was just like, oh. So he was completely overwhelmed by something that I would imagine most of us take for granted. But just coming back to, what is a point that could be drawn out from? Is there any significance from that little exercise? So I quite like the idea of principles that operate on one level of conditionality and then can be seen echoed on higher levels. And that one there is obviously the principle that what we perceive is conditioned by the context in which we perceive it. So you could say the same is true of emotional states or mental states. So if you've had a spell of dullness and darkness and despair and depression, and then you have a spot, you have a little square of joy, even if it's mild, in contrast, it can seem like, wow, out of this world. And I think that was my experience pre-getting involved, is that those little meditative experiences I had in the garden shed were such a contrast to my usual experience that I perceived them as brighter or bigger or deeper than they possibly were. And the Brahmajala Sutta, just to mention a bit of Buddhism, is the Buddha addressing this very problem of meditative experiences and what's the conceptual concept that we put around them that helps explain them. And it's so easy, so tricky, so easy to miss the mark. So the other phrase I used in relation to the Tantra was this notion of making available what is of use. And I've said I'm not going to talk about sadhana practice, but I'm going to talk about the related areas of receptivity and of uncovering the spiritual qualities that colours can evoke. So I quite like this idea. I think maybe the Tibetans are quite good at this, is where if they recognise that we're conditioned by something and that could possibly be used, that they make use of it, you know. So they have all these high lamas and gurus and stuff, because actually, you know, a lot of us are, you know, influenced by hierarchy to some extent. So why not use that, you know, a sort of spiritual line manager, you know, and it has an impact on you. We have an appetite for approval, and so we have these glorious Buddhas and Bodhisattvas smiling at us, saying, you know, well done, and giving us lots of likes, you know, transcendental likes springing out from their heart centres. And if something isn't present, if you don't have an enlightened guru or someone who can pull that off for a spell before it all hits the fan, then you can imagine them. So we can use our imagination, and ordinarily in our everyday experience with people in any way, when they're actually present, we're using our imaginations. We are filling in the gaps of what we think other people are thinking and feeling and what their intentions are, because we cannot actually directly see other people's states of mind. So we guess. And that's fine once we realise we're guessing. It becomes a problem if we have a sense of certainty about where someone's coming. That can create problems. So being open to that fact that we're guessing is okay. Once we don't think that we know for sure where someone else is coming from, without checking with them. And we do this with other people, so we fill in the gaps of our lack of awareness with other people by using our imagination. We also do it with ourselves. So there's aspects of ourselves, and who knows how much terrain is unknown. We can open up to and be receptive to what is other within ourselves. There was recently a film, I think it was called The Arrival, Aliens, and they communicated, these like strange looking creatures, just my opinion, communicated in a very unusual way, and in a way, colour can be that for us. Colours and symbols can be that sort of language where we can get into dialogue with and be receptive to those parts of our own being that are unknown to us, and also those parts of others that are unknown. So it can be a receptive, it can be a medium for being receptive. Buddhism provides us with lots of meaningful associations and connections with colour. But in order for that to come to life and have meaning, we've got to sort of do some work ourselves. And what I'm going to suggest we do now is a brief little exercise. And what I'm going to ask you to do is if you allow yourself to, you can leave your eyes open or you can close them if you like, but I'm going to ask you, it's going to do like an imaginative exercise. So what I'd like you to do is bring to mind a difficulty that you've had at some point, a difficult situation. Maybe you've got lots to choose from, but you know, it doesn't have to be a big one, but just some sort of difficulty you've had. It can be in the recent past or in the distant past, and allow yourself to just get a sense of that, have that, just a little bit of a sense of that. I don't want to sort of drag everyone into a horrible state. And then what I'm wondering is if you can get a sense of what quality would have been beneficial for you to have had at that point. Some sort of something that may have helped how you responded to the situation, or something that would have allowed you to feel more at peace with what was happening and going on. So some sort of quality, and you can either allow a word or what have you to spring to mind. But what I'd invite you to do is to get a sense of what colour, if there was a colour out in front of you, what colour might represent that beneficial quality that would have been helpful for you at that point in your life. And having a sense of that colour outside of you, and maybe you could allow it, if you want, to be maybe it's in the shape of an orb or some other appropriate shape. And there's a sense of you being present with that quality, that colour quality. And if you like, you could have a sense of that colour, that quality, sending some coloured light towards you so that that quality within you is brought to life. And you have a sense of that beneficial quality that would have helped you then in that difficult situation is resonating with those qualities within yourself. Okay, and so then you can just allow that just to dissolve in whatever way you want. Now I'm at an interesting point in the talk where I need to end it, and what I'd like to do is just suggest that I don't have any fantastic poetry or quotes, I'm afraid, but maybe some will spring to mind for you, yeah? But what I suggest we can do is that we can bear in mind that actually we've got this issue where we can forget what's important to us. We can forget that without meaning to. We can do that for a long time. We can lose touch with what we value and what's important to us. But we can use and tap into the qualities, the resources around us, and we can invest colours with meaning. And then we've got, throughout the day, we can have reminders of those qualities that we want to cultivate and develop, and that we want to live by, so that whatever the circumstances we're in, we've got allies and spiritual friends, in a sense, that are supporting and encouraging us. So, yeah, I'll leave it there.